So today, what I'm hoping to do is kind of set the framework and the outline for what's the practice periods talks are. As you know, it's the paramitas, the six paramitas, and I have like eight or nine talks to do. So I wanted this one to talk more about kind of the background about the paramitas and what they are, and then also on this one, sort of the stuff I've been talking about with body work, sense feelings and things like that. So there'll be a little bit of science, anatomy, physiology, and then depending on the time, we'll hopefully go through an exercise that is sort of going to be the framework. And then after that, it'll be a little talk, little exercise, some reflections. So that's the little journey I'm kind of hoping to go on today. So I thought I would start with more about, you know, how I came to study the paramitas. And it actually was something I picked up quite a few years ago. It was Dale S. Wright's book. And for whatever reason, it sort of drew my attention. I think probably part of it was just the title. This was sort of the six, like a nice small number. Perfections, which is also something that I get drawn to. I have this little game that I play in life on having a perfect day and never making it, you know, or whatever. But I like the notion of perfection or whatever. So, but if anybody's familiar with Wright, you'll find that he's a bit dense and scholarly, so it can take a bit of doing to get through them. So I've been dragging his book around quite a bit, and every once in a while I'd take a run at it and I'd read part of it and I'd, you know, trail off or whatever on that. And then as we came closer to this on picking a topic, it was like, this is something I've talked to Kate and Michael about a lot, about doing that along with the body work. And then once we committed to it, and I was starting to do research on it, lo and behold, for whatever reason, in San Francisco, I don't know what's going on down there, three sort of leading teachers decided to write books on the paramitas, which was infinitely easier for me because then I wasn't stuck with a lot of trolling around through texts and stuff like that. It like for a little bit there, it sort of felt like, oh, you took my idea, you know, so I'm kind of a little on record that I had the idea first, you know, on that. So I really am curious. I'm going to want to see if I can ask one of them what that was all about, because I find that kind of odd, you know. And then I find out too, or serendipitous, our other member who's probably at his own sangha, John Green, is he's going to do apparently the same topic down in Seattle. So anyhow, something's converged on that. So the books I've talked about are kind of the ones that I'll be working off of mostly are Dale Wright's book, Diane Rossetto with The Deep Hope, Zen Guidance for Staying Steadfast, Reb Anderson, who has Entering the Mind of the Buddha and the Six Heroic Practices, and of course, Norman Fisher, The World Could Be Otherwise. And then I'll periodically touch into some other books, you know, that we certainly have. There's historical texts about the Bodhisattva vows, and then there's a lot of other references that'll be in there. So I'll probably be moving around, and because I had three contemporaries, it's kind of hard to ignore any one of them, but there's some that you kind of lean to their explanation a little bit more than others. So just as a review, there's the six paramitas that we're going to study. And I'm going to also give you the other folks' interpretations of what they call them. So, and it's sort of, like I said, it's kind of nice to have some choices around it. So the first one is Dana Paramita, which is generosity or giving and receiving, or the perfection of giving and a generous heart. Sila Paramita, which is ethical conduct, or the perfection of morality. Other interpretations are taking skill for action, or a virtuous life. Kshanti Paramita is patience, classically, tolerance and practicing patience. And I think this is Reb's perfection of patience, radiant presence. Nice. Virya Paramita, joyful effort, engaging effort, perfection of energy, the perfection of enthusiasm or joyful effort, again. Dhyana Paramita, meditation or the perfection of concentration. And Prajna Paramita, wisdom or understanding, seeing clearing, or perfection of wisdom, body and mind dropping off. So the extremely brief history of the paramitas, is where they come from, is with the Mahayana Buddhism tradition. It's an evolution and still quite old, over 2,000 years old. And I think Michael talked to Kate, talked about lists. And so we have groups of three, sila, morality, samadhi, concentration and prajna, groups of five, groups of 10, groups of others, you know, and then some people even surmise that some came up with 10 because of the change in the numerical system, you know, so, and then this is settling in on the six. And to me, that just seems just right, the right amount. So these are the perfections of the Bodhisattva. So I thought I'd dial it back a little bit more and just who exactly are these Bodhisattvas we're talking about. I know I certainly got heard about that early in my practice and people, oh, that's Bodhisattva work. And I'm like, am I a Bodhisattva? You know, like, what are these Bodhisattvas? So according to Norman, this is in many others, but I'm taking this out of his book, is that the Mahayana envisioned the Buddha more as a cosmic entity and not a wise human being. And so they saw the Buddha as beyond being human in their problems. And he was more of a benevolent background figure whose job was to enable and inspire. And so they installed a kind of a new figure of religious inspiration and salvation called the Bodhisattva. And those are those destined to become a Buddha and a Buddha in training. And just love, you probably, some of you have probably read it, you know, the Mahayana Bodhisattvas are the energizer bunnies of Buddhism, and innocent and enthusiastic. They make endless effort to do endless practice and to perform endless beneficial acts on behalf of others. They are happy and to defer their own awakening until every other sentient being is saved. And then at that point, I'm like, I can hear Norman, isn't that amazing? Like, isn't that really amazing? You know, like, oh my gosh, you know, like, yeah. So... and so I was sort of looking at it too on in some of the, you know, am I a Bodhisattva? Like I said, you know, I kind of, I've heard that kind of tossed around and, you know, where does that, you know, how do you become a Bodhisattva? And I would suggest that it comes from the, whatever seed of inspiration is there. And so Wright talks about, you know, we're pulled in on questioning, how shall I live? And we look to see how we can look after ourselves and expand, and, you know, either for ourselves or to other human beings. And so we have this imagination of lives that are better than what's going on right now. And so I would suggest that with that, you know, that even the fact that you've come through the door, even in the fact that you've sat down once, even for any of that, that qualifies. And even if you haven't even formulated that thought, it still qualifies. So welcome to the Bodhisattva Club. So, But the other part of it too is that, see, not so quick, you know, and you have noticed that we do recite vows regularly about our practice. And those are very important too, obviously. And I kind of liked Shohaku Okumura's description that for the Bodhisattva, vow is essential. And it's essential because living by, it distinguishes living by vow versus living by karma. And the meaning of karma, and as he explains it, is that it's this habit or a preference of ready-made systems of values. As we grow up, as we learn a system of values from the culture around us, which we use to evaluate and choose actions. So it's kind of predefined, pre-registered, not much choice. In contrast, Bodhisattva lives by vow, and it's the vow is like a magnet or a compass that shows us the way. So we have the general Bodhisattva vows that we take, and then there's particular vows that individuals might take. So for example, often we're asked in practice, you know, like what you practice about. And for myself, it was more around supporting community. And because of where I am in my life, you know, I'm semi-retired. I've got time to do things that people who are, you know, in their earlier stages of life and are running around working and raising kids and doing all of that stuff don't have time to do. So that was part of my practice. We often sometimes pick, there's might be a Bodhisattva that we, you know, get inspiration from, you know, so Samatthahadra Bodhisattva was one that I've always kind of gravitated to, and great activity. And I was actually just doing a little bit of, I looked it up a little bit more about, you know, great activity, enlightening activity in the world. And embodies the luminous web of interconnectedness of all beings and more universal virtue. And it's like, it's sort of interesting who we kind of take, we resonate with, because I sort of go, well, that, yeah, that's sort of, I can relate to that kind of aspect, that this is a generalist versus a, you know, a specialist, right? You know, so but the other part that I thought was quite cute was, apparently the image of Samatthahadra is that is often depicted riding on a six-tusked, seven-legged, magical white elephant. And with every step of the elephant's gait, Dharma wheels containing white lotuses spring up beneath its feet as they are about to touch the ground. And that Samatthahadra is usually depicted very poised and very serene and smooth expression. But the elephants are quite expressive with wildly hilarious and amazing grins. So I thought, well, that's kind of, I like that. I like that a lot. So it's not just, you know, it's a great image. Let's put it that way. So we have our vows that we're going to chant later. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Great. How hard could that be? Right. So Norman, of course, bails us out. The saving grace of the Bodhisattva ideal is that it's so outrageously extravagant, so absurdly imaginative, that we are clear from the start that we can never realize it. It is literally impossible. All we can do is keep walking toward the Bodhisattva horizon. So that leads us to the paramitas, which I see as kind of the learner or training manual of the Bodhisattva. And paramita, we think a lot of you know this, is traditionally defined as the perfections or going beyond or transcending or crossing the shore or the river. Diane Risotto has a nice succinct way of talking about the shore, where we go from the shore of self-absorption to another, where we realize that our own well-being, of others, alls, planets are interconnected. And the parable of the raft that is traditionally associated with the Paramitas has four elements. There's the shore that we're on with fear, uncertainty, sickness, and death, all that causes pain and suffering to ourselves and others. There's the distant shore, which is the deep capacity to bear the suffering and take action, compassion, and love for our fellow human beings. The water, which is not static in width and flow, that's in between, and the raft that takes us across, which is the Buddha's teachings. So we have that as the outline, and there's lots of ancient texts that talk about that. And so, but our commentary, our contemporary commentaries are, there's a little problem with the word perfections, because the imagery itself can lead to an end point, you know, of enlightenment. And so we have other ways of looking at them. So they're a path in training and being fully ourselves and allowing things to be fully themselves. And it's the spirit of the practice is to spark the imagination. It's from Norman. Inspire hope from Rossetto. Or as an heroic practice from Anderson. So they're inspiration, not fixed views. Wright, he also talks about, you know, what can we reasonably and ideally aspire to be under the circumstances that we now face? And what are we perfecting in the six perfections? And his idea is that the best word in English for, from his perspective, would be character. It's a disposition to engage in the world in a chosen end, a tendency to impress a thought of enlightenment upon all acts and choices. Also presupposes conceiving of yourself as free and responsible, free to choose what you do and responsible for the outcome of these actions. And it implies the capacity to cultivate the desire that motivate your action and depth of character. So we're back to the vow versus karmic forces. And to guide life practice. And like I said, reading all, you bounce around these authors, you know, and they all give you really good other ways of thinking about it. So Diane also talks about using them as nouns and states of body and mind, or expressing them as verbs, as continuing evolving process. And the one that she talks about that I like is the image. And you if you get know me at all, I'm all about image, you know, and anything I can do pictorially, and it's not a, you know, it's not an unusual one, but the paramitas are the balanced wheel, and each spoke is like spokes on a bicycle, and each one reinforces the other, but you need them all, and they form this supporting, interlocking support. They are classically studied in order, and we're going to do that. But as we found, like even on Wednesday, you find out very quickly you have to move back and forth between them fairly well. But I kind of look at this as that right now we're going to build the wheel and put one spoke in at a time and take a look at and see how it fits, you know, and then you can spend the rest of your eternity tweaking it and making sure it runs smoothly for you and evenly and so on. So they are placid orders, and then I have seen different descriptions, but the first three are said to bring benefit to living beings, so the gender, including ourselves. And the second three are practices that go beyond benefiting sentient beings to liberating them. And so there is some suggestion about meditation and wisdom being more advanced, but we'll probably discover that's not really the case. Let's look at my time. I did say to Kate and Michael, this might be my longest talk, hopefully, and then it'll be shorter from here on in, but we'll see. I think I'm still good. So that's sort of the foundation on that. So part two is going to be doing quite a big pivot. And this is sort of where my imagination got going on trying to use body and sensations to accompany the study. So, and you can't, my interest on that is, you know, from my own personal experiences with my health and well-being and the kind of gradual awareness of how much I was learning, for lack of a better word, through my body as opposed through my intellect and what I was experiencing on my cushion and off my cushion. And so this is kind of more of a primer around kind of the, you know, the psychology and the neurobiology of where we are. And this is sort of the beauty of being able to practice today, that our ancestors certainly had inkling of, there's no question, more than an inkling. They just didn't maybe have the concrete, tangible evidence that us, you know, Western modern skeptics might need to have. I know I do, you know, so just cue kind of a fast here. So certainly we have our historical views that we've actually even in this, in to modern day, that has influenced how we feel about body and mind. And it starts as early as Hippocrates and goes, you know, on knowing that there was a connection between physiology, mental and emotional states, and that they certainly recognized that there were things that couldn't be well explained outside of organic physiology. And then we have more stuff, you know, in the 1800s with all of the different psychologists and psychiatrists that were coming up with these links between traumatic events and symptoms with no physical basis. Of course, Sigmund Freud being one of the ones that cottoned on to that. Though I did notice there was a distinct theme during those decades on hysteria and focus obviously on women and I guess their lack of sensibility or whatever they thought was problematic at the time, but just curious about that. And then certainly the development during the world wars, you know, where they started to see the whole psychoneuroses and war shock, shell shock and PTSD with the Vietnam War. So as we move along and we have the benefit of MRIs and CT scans and research and EEGs, you know, there's a lot of study around the neuroscience and what some of the authors is that there's a greater appreciation for the sense of ourselves being connected into our bodies. And so one of the authors that I've drawn on here is Bessel van der Kolk, who talks about everything being carried out in the theater of the body. So, and how the body keeps the score. And this is like on all events. It's not necessarily negative events. It's all events on how we interpret our world. And that, you know, we got these big brilliant brains that help us a lot, but they're a little bit of our curse too, because we tend to draw on previous experience and react a little quicker to stimuli before the thought process comes in. And so you can misinterpret based on your past experiences. And so you can end up in these reinforcing loops. Most people know that, right? You know, and then the paradox of these loops is that the more we loop, especially against negative thought things, is that we get more and more guarded, and the more guarded we get, the more we loop, and the more we avoid, which is, like I said, paradoxically the problem, because the more we avoid, we can't deal with it, so we just continue to reinforce. So, but it's not our fault. It's our brain's fault, you know, and how it was designed, right? So just a little, you know, on that, we know we've got the left and right side of the brain, And I know people know this, but some, you know, just a little primer. And the right side is the intuitive emotional side. The left is the linguistic and logical side, analytical side. We have the reptilian brain, which is responsible for survival. And then we have the limbic system, which is the mammalian brain that all animals that live in groups and nurture young have. And that's the seat of emotions, monitor of danger, and shaped in response to experience. So it's our reptilian and limbic brains that are posited to equal our emotional brain. And so during stress, this is the part of the brain that reacts, looks for help, or can't find any help, fights or flies, flight, freezes or collapses. And then we have other parts of our brain that are younger, and they're a little bit more rational and can discern a little bit more. I talked about that in my one about the watchtower and part of the brain and the smoke detector part of the brain. But they're younger and, like I said, kind of last on the circuitry. But that's sort of where some of the problems lies, because we get this reaction before the brain, the thinking part, gets in there. And then my favorite part of all of this is around the vagus nerve. And this is the part of the system, is part of the cranial nerve system that connects all of the body and brain and systems and organs together. So it's the... it's like an electrical system. The vagus nerve in particular, that means wandering, rambling, or strolling. And it's probably because it's difficult to kind of pin down what it does, because it's all over the body, literally. The nicest or best explanation that I've gravitated to is that even though it's the 10th and it's the largest, it's been referred to, this is Risma Menakem in his book of My Grandmother's Hands, refers to it as the soul nerve. And I really like that one, because, and then I'm just going to read directly from him. So there's not a lot, still lots we don't understand, but this is where we experience love, compassion, fear, grief, sadness, hope. When your body reacts to an emotional response, like your stomach clenching, voice catching, pulse racing, heart opening and closing, spirit soaring, all of these involve your soul nerve. When your body feels relaxed, open, settled, and in sync with other body parts, that's your soul nerve functioning. When it feels energized, vibrant, full of life, that's also your soul nerve. And when it feels tight, constricted, and self-protective, that's your soul nerve too. So I find that just like my mind just always kind of blows, and I reference that to my like own experiences of long history of vagal vasoreactions that I've had from a child, you know, and appreciating that, you know, that was the result of probably an overloaded system that got overloaded and then tended to react, not logically, it would just react. So one of my classic Kathy moves was when I was called as a kid, was that we would go to church. We would have been fasting. Church was okay. We'd be kneeling. And the next thing you know, Kathy would be under the pew, passed out, being dragged out by her heels, holy water getting splashed on her face, you know, and it would just be something. But it was obviously, in retrospect, probably one of those days that my poor little system just couldn't handle it. So it came across as that, right? You know, so, and it's some of this stuff starts to really become clear when you look at life under that lens, right? So And then when we look at things like why do massage and yoga and all of these practices work, it's because it's actually tapping in literally and physically to your parasympathetic, which is connected to your vagus nerve. And so you kind of start doing this reverse engineering of relaxing the vagus and getting things settled. So our poor little system, like I've alluded to, when it's there, when it's functioning well, it's great. You know, it reacts, it does its thing. You run away from the snake, you run away from whatever it is, and then you're fine. Where life gets difficult, of course, is when we have a disproportionate amount of stimuli that's coming in, or there's chronic problems that are going on, and that all of these things that normally should have just abated just keep going and going and going and going to the point where now you can't figure out what's going on and your body is locked into the chemical reactions and mind reactions that go with. So for those of you that are pretty, and I know lots of you are pretty smart, you're probably hearing trauma-informed kind of concepts in there and what's going on in that lens. And you're also probably hearing the language of karma and habit problems and mind habits and things like that. And that kind of leads me to where we look at our teachings, we sit on our cushion, we're told about practicing with the body. We'd hear things like dropping away the body, losing your body, losing yourself. But not a whole lot of how to do, you know, and what exactly we're doing there. And so I think sometimes we just kind of, it could feel like you're set adrift a little bit on that whole thing, on what's going on the cushion, right? But eventually we, you know, people start to recognize that there is something going on internally. So that's my framework there. That's weird talking by yourself in here. So I'm going to ask at this stage to be a willing participant. This is the part that, well, from the body part on, I'm like sort of going, never tried this before, never worked with a group before, and for whatever reason, I've decided that you guys will be willing participants and happy to go along with this journey, and then we'll see how it goes. But, and today, and I think, we've still got lots of time to do, what I want to do is to go through like a guided meditation and I'll do some suggestions. This is clearly not Zen, but it's been cleared by the teachers. And what I'm trying to do is offer some suggestions to give a different perspective, you know, and a different doorway to explore. Let's put it that way. And that my intention is that this would be kind of tapping into sense feelings, you know, like in how we kind of interpret, like, you know, the words will be like raindrops or mist that maybe you'll be able to somehow play around with and explore. So to that, I'll give you the caveat, is that for this, totally optional. If you want to participate in it, great. I'd appreciate it. I'd like the feedback. But if you don't like this kind of stuff and you think it's a bit too airy-fairy, I totally get it. If you talked to me 10 years ago, I would have said exactly the same thing. So you can leave the room. You can turn off your Zoom. You can turn down the volume. You can leave if you want, you know, or whatever on that. But just to assure you that I don't plan on doing any deep dives into anything. We're going to try and keep it as gentle and as optional on that, on any of that. And then it's also, if anybody's going to come along for the whole series, is that Yeah, just that when we get to this part of it, that you'll be able to kind of set yourselves up and get as comfy as possible. So on this part, I'm going to ask you to get as comfy as possible. And I know you're already pretty comfy because we asked you to do that with it. But if you want to get even more comfy, I invite you to lie down, get on it, you know, put your feet up, go in kind of a rested posture. If that feels funny, feel free to turn off your screen to do that. Get a blanket, get some warm socks on, anything that will get you nice and comfy and relaxed. Maybe not sleeping, but if you fall asleep, that's okay too, you know. So, and if you want to stay in your Zazen, if your typical Zazen position is your most comfortable, you know, that's fine too. There's no right or wrong for that. So we'll take just a couple. I see people running around with blankets and pillows. That's great, you know. So this is it. I'll take a couple of minutes. I'll get my bell. So yeah, and I'll just take a few minutes to let you settle. I'll do the bell. That'll get me, and then we'll just talk it through, and I'll talk you through, and we'll go from there. So I'll be right back. Okay. I love it. I love the ones that are doing pillows. Perfect. Okay. So this will go slow. So as you settle into your position, and as your body begins to ease, the invitation would be maybe to perhaps take a couple of deep breaths in and out, like a cleansing breath. And perhaps another. And then as you choose, you can find a breath pattern for you that is calm and comfortable. And take a few moments and a few cycles of breath in your own way. Your eyes can be open, they can be shut. And just breathe. And as you settle and you move about, begin to be aware of the points of your body that are in connection to your seat, your cushion, the soles of your feet on the floor, your back against the chair, if that's how you're seated. Hands and what they're in contact with. And just notice any pressures or points of contact. And if there's nothing to notice, that's fine too. Just have the intention for your body towards feeling comfortable. And as you settle, are there any other parts of your body that feel really comfortable and relaxed? And can you in there get just a little bit more ease, 1% more, 2% more? Or perhaps move some of that ease to a part of your body, a it's not quite there yet. So now the invitation is to explore any parts of the body that are connected a little more softly with your internal or external environment. The sensation of your breath along your nostrils. The temperature or sensation of the air as it's drawn into your lungs and out again. The texture of your clothing as it meets your skin. Or any sounds. Just notice. And as you breathe, relax and notice, consider these vows of the Bodhisattva as written by Santideva. May I be a guard for those who need protection, a guide for those on the path, a boat, a raft, a bridge for those who wish to cross the flood. May I be a lamp in the darkness, a resting place for the weary, a healing medicine for all who are sick, a vase of plenty, a tree of miracles, and for the boundless multitudes of living beings. May I bring sustenance and awakening, enduring like the earth and sky, until all beings are freed from sorrow, and all are awakened. May I be a guard for those who need protection, a guide for those on the path, a boat, a raft, a bridge for those who wish to cross the flood. May I be a lamp in the darkness, a resting place for the weary, a healing medicine for all who are sick, a vase of plenty, a tree of miracles, and for the boundless multitudes of living beings, may I bring sustenance and awakening, enduring like the earth and sky, until all beings are freed from sorrow and all are awakened. So now the invitation will be to bring yourself back to more alert awareness. You may wish to begin with gently moving your hands and feet. Perhaps some fuller breaths, or a nice stretch, or yawn. And gradually, in your own time, return to your seat, Zoom space, and back into our shared space. Okay, I think that's enough people that look like they're back. So the really homework, but what my hope would be is that as a reflection that you consider what sensations stood out for you or not. Were there any that surprised you? Any that made you curious? Any parts of your body that you noticed that didn't seem to feel anything, were neutral or unexplored? And if you're able to identify that as such, and it might not come until later, how might you carry the awareness of those sensations to inform your day-to-day practice? And for some, and because this is sort of my fervent belief, if you can keep it in the nonverbal as a color or a texture or something like that, that or something that sparks an image. And this is kind of unrelated, but it was from the other. And then maybe on this journey, if we go through the bodhisattva perfections, that you, a spirit animal of sort or a spirit entity. I personally, looking at the grinning elephant maybe for part of the journey, I'll see how that goes. It'll probably change. I thank you for joining me. I hope I see you again next week. We'll see if you got put off or not. You know, I will totally understand, but if it didn't, so. And otherwise, oh my God. Yeah, right on time. So we will close things. May our
genically extend to every place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I bow to become.